All right, Song of Solomon, chapter 6. I'm going to share with you, and I know some of you are new, I don't recognize at least being to this study, and I'll share with you again. I take a little bit of a different position on Song of Solomon in that I think it's a love song for sure, but not of Solomon and a Shulamite woman, but of a Shulamite woman and a shepherd, a country boy shepherd. And Solomon has brought this woman into his potential harem. There's obvious languages in language in this that speaks of polygamy, and I don't think it fits. I don't think it fits with her devoted love for the shepherd she keeps referring to, or her pet name, if I can use that terminology, my beloved. I think there's some obvious indications even in the language. You might disagree with that. I hope that doesn't take you out of the study, though, because there's some beautiful things about husband and wife here that we can all receive from. So I just have to teach what I believe. I think you understand that, right? I couldn't teach well if I didn't believe it. So I see this a little bit different. But I'm not alone on that. Chapter 6, verse 1. Whither is thy beloved gone, O thou fairest among women? Whither is thy beloved turned aside, that we may seek him with thee? You might remember, and we're going back a couple weeks now, but you might remember in chapter 5 there was a fight, basically. Okay, there was a little bit of turmoil in this relationship. Can you relate? Maybe not. Maybe you have that perfect Leave It to Beaver family. But maybe you can relate. Maybe you've had, like myself, a tiff or two with that beautiful lady of yours. Well, in chapter 5, it sure seems that there's some strain in this relationship. You might remember, it's kind of depicted in a cool way. He shows up unannounced really early in the morning, knocking on the door, come on, let me in. And she wouldn't. She wouldn't get out of bed and let him in. And there seems to be an exchange through the door. And finally she gets up and she goes and opens up the door and he's gone. Too late, and he's off. And she grabs the door and she smells her hand and it smells of him, which we talked about as a cultural thing, lo and behold. And she goes out probably in a nightgown, probably in some night attire, not immodest attire, but in a nightgown. She runs out before the sun is high in the sky and she's looking for him in the village. And this is my radical suggestion, and I realize that. But I kind of see chapter 5 as the abduction chapter. Sorry to say it that way, but I do. I see this as the point where she was taken, and probably it's from that point where she ends up in a potential harem of King Solomon. And there's some really interesting verses that cause me to think that way. One of them being she's beaten up and wounded by the gatekeepers of the village at night. And it's a very interesting thing that kind of unfold. It seems like that's the point where she has been officially separated from her husband, separated from the one that she loves. And remember, she gets around all these daughters of Jerusalem, I maintain, other potential wives of Solomon, a harem that is being groomed. And if you've read the book of Esther, this isn't abnormal at all. That's exactly how it would work. A whole pool of ladies would be drawn from all different cultures and surrounding nations. And they would kind of parade themselves, and I hate to use that term, in front of the king. They would go through a series of different etiquettes, and the king would make his selections, plural. Okay, so the daughters of Jerusalem seem to be a title of the other ladies in this book that this Shulamite woman is conversing with. Very interesting to me. And they basically put the question up, and I want to remind us of this question. They say, what is so special about this guy anyway? These Jerusalem daughters, they are quite happy to be here. They're quite happy to be potentially solicited by the king. They're seeing their financial life, at least, about to change and change for the good. They're about to see, you know, I could be treated like a princess for the rest of my life, live in this beautiful palace, eat the finest of foods. Yeah, I got to share the king with all these other women, but, hey, you know, girl can't have it all. But there seems to be in this strong indication of a material drive, the finer things of life, and willing to compromise what is more meaningful to me, and that is devotion and loyalty to this woman, probably sincerely. Like, we don't get it. What's the big deal about this guy? What's the big deal about this beloved of yours? You know, you could potentially be a queen in this situation. And you remember, what's the big deal? She says, what's the big deal? And she describes her man there at the end of chapter 5. Whether you take that as to be Solomon or a poor shepherd boy that's not the king, a Lebanese shepherd, which I do, whether you take that position or not, you got to hear the love in her heart, right? As she describes the physical stature, the eyes, you know, even his aroma that's very familiar to her at this point. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool how she describes this man with that little, you know, glisten in her eyes as she shares with her lady friends. Let me tell you all about him, which is cool because chapter 6 opens up with, well, where is he now, O fairest among women? Where is he gone? Where is he turned aside? You know, based on that description, we'll help you find him. So very interesting to me. These ladies are now curious themselves after this description. You think the description was a bit exaggerated? Have you ever noticed that love is like that? I have. You probably have heard me talk about my wife for 15 years, right? And there's something about love that makes you, like, see no flaws and see something that is maybe a little bit exaggerated. Do you know what I'm talking about? I do. I see it among kids when they talk about their dad. You know, my dad is the toughest dad on the earth. And, you know, us adult men, you know, cute kid. But you know how we get, right? We kind of, you know, dramatize our affection. And I see some of that going on here personally. But in her mind, that man is the most attractive, handsome, just finest catch on earth. And she's convinced of it. And that's what's important, right? That's what's important. She is convinced. He is a find. Where is he? We'll help you find him. And here's a very interesting realization. She says in verse 2, my beloved is gone down into his garden to the bed of spices to feed in the gardens, to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, I'll say it old school, and my beloved is mine. He feeds among the lilies. Now remember, his occupation is, shout it out if you know, you've been here for a while, what's his occupation? He's a shepherd. Clearly, there's tons of references to that. Feeding his flock. And it's not uncommon. In fact, I think it's 3 times total in the book where the pasture that he feeds his flock is referred to as a garden. It's a wild pasture. And the description here is wild things growing. You know, mountain thyme, sage, lilies. These are all wild flowers, okay? And so as she sits there, I maintain as a captive, she's like, I know where he is. You know, I ran into the village to find him. He went back to work, you know, and realizing, you know, if I just would have gone there instead of running into town, maybe we'd be together right now. But the description, if you have a little bit of shepherding knowledge, it's even interesting, isn't it? He's there in the pasture where he's feeding his flocks, is the idea, and he's gathering lilies. Now, why would a shepherd gather lilies? Well, because lilies, lupins, bracken, they're all very toxic to sheep. So you'd pick them, bundle them up, and get them out of the area so that your sheep wouldn't eat them, whether they're accidental or there's nothing else left, and they'll eat them if nothing else is left, and get very sick, and you could lose them. You know, sheep have a extremely delicate digestive system. There's a little flora in there. There's a very delicate balance of bacteria, and you can lose a sheep very fast. I've experienced it. If anything at all is off in terms of their diet, they're very finicky animals. I have one section of my pasture where every single spring these beautiful lilies of the valley show up. Those little beautiful, delicate little white bell-looking flowers. They smell beautiful. My wife loves them. They'll kill my sheep. So you got to get in there early, you know, as soon as they spring up, and you got to get a spade, and you got to dig them up, and you got to root them out. Shepherds gather lilies for that purpose. So again, I don't personally see this as a description of King Solomon caring about the sheep of Israel. I don't see that. I see, again, she's making a statement of the very good and proficient and expert shepherd that her man, as she knows him to be. Even that, to me, is adorable. You know, my husband is the best roofer on the planet. Don't tell her. No, come on, please. Let her think that. It's fun. But we do that sometimes, right? We kind of see our man. And of course, he comes home and talks about the other men that he works with. These guys are a bunch of clowns. They don't know what they're doing. And so over the years, you start to get convinced, like, wow, he really is, you know, just a leader among the roofing community. Again, she is describing her man. You know how this works. As the best of the best. He's a shepherd doing his job. That's where he is. And so she's just so sure her man is there in that garden doing his job faithfully as he's always done, which I think says a lot about his character personally. Verse 4. And if I were to give my comments on verse 4, which I suppose is the point of preacher's preaching, I think this is where King Solomon chimes in. Let's read about it. King Solomon, I maintain, says, "Thou art beautiful, O my love, as Tirzah, comely as Jerusalem." I want to remind you something. When there's an obvious exchange between my beloved, as she refers to her husband as, the shepherd boy, I maintain, and he talks about her beauty and she talks about his handsomeness, all the reference points, do you remember? All the reference points were that of Lebanon. All these geographical places in Lebanon are being used, I maintain, because that's where they're both from. The Shulamite woman from Lebanon, that's why it comes up so much, and the shepherd boy that she loves from Lebanon. And they're talking and using those reference points. But it's very interesting here in this description, this individual, this male individual who's attempting to flatter this woman based on her beauty is using all Jewish or Israel reference points. Tirzah, which was a very beautiful Canaanite city captured by the Jews, it eventually becomes the capital city of the northern kingdom, actually. This is a beautiful city, okay, taken over by the Jews when they came into the land under Joshua. Of course, Jerusalem, a beautiful Jewish city. Those are the two cities used by this man to describe the beauty and the gloriousness of this woman that he's trying to solicit, trying to win her heart. No, being black like she was, and she describes her skin as being very black, and you know, not necessarily an emphasis on ethnicity, but more of an emphasis as being under the sun as a laborer. She was a poor lady. Of course, in this biblical age, you know, really pale white skin spoke of affluence. You didn't have to be out in the sun, right? You were pampered and powdered all the time. And unfortunately, people learned to, you know, be more attracted to that because it said something about your pocketbook. And this woman would say of herself in the very beginning of the book, you know, I work under the sun all day. I'm a country girl. I work hard. These hands are not smooth. My skin has been scorched by the sun. That's a description here, okay? My point is this. I know hard-working ladies. We got a church full of them. You know, women that live their life serving their families in their gardens. And if I can say this without being weird, Proverbs 31 women all through our church. And I love you for that, my sisters. I see how you serve your families. I see the hours you put in to put food away and sew. And it's crazy to me personally that we live in a culture that spits on that or acts like that's less. Isn't that nuts? I'd put you ladies up against any one of those little princesses. And let's compare a work ethic. Let's compare a heart and a depth. And I'm not trying to make problems either. I'm just saying it's commendable. But say to a girl like that, man, you're like this big, wealthy, beautiful, flamboyant city. And what do you get? Ooh. I'd rather be compared to something like camp or something simple is the idea. This king, he's using all his tricks. It's not affecting her, I maintain. He's using all his tools that have worked in the past, but she's like iron, this lady. You save your flattery. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Terrible as an army with banners. I'm not sure if that would be a compliment, ladies. If I were to say to my wife, you are as terrible as an army with banners. Terrible means awesome. I understand that. You are as awesome as an army with banners. thanks. Stop. Put the kids to bed early. You know, I don't think I'd get that reaction personally. It gets worse. Turn away thine eyes from me, for they have overcome me. That's this male, I believe Solomon, suggesting, you know, your eyes are so intriguing. Don't even look at me. Don't even look at me. But there's a game going on there. He's trying to flatter her. You know, flattery is something in the scriptures that we're actually told is something that we need to be warned of. Flattery is the strongest indication that you or I are attempted to be manipulated. Flattery and manipulation are partners in crime. You understand that, right? Read Proverbs chapter 7, for example. This goofy, doofus kid who Solomon's looking through the window of his home, he says, that boy right there is an idiot. And if you read Proverbs chapter 7, that's the way he words it in my modern spin. He's a dumb kid, and we know that because he was in an area where there's prostitution while the sun's going down. Just unwise to be there. But do you remember how she, this prostitute in Proverbs 7, got this young man to come with her and go into this place where, by the way, he never came out alive, morally speaking, by flattery? Remember? I've been looking for you all day, and there you are. You, I finally found you. And this kid's looking around. Me? And the knucklehead buys it, hook, line, and sinker. There's 1,000 men that went by her corner that night. Every one of them heard the same pitch. You're different. You're special. No, she wants what's in your wallet, buddy. She wants your throat, not anything else. But yet, flattery, to this day, is one of the most effective ways to bring a man to his knees. Would you agree? Or a woman, for that matter. Flattery is used by our enemy to manipulate and cause us to put our walls down, morally and spiritually speaking, and to be very vulnerable in the flesh. We have got to train our ear to recognize flattery. I'm not talking about compliments. Hey, great Bible study. Great song. Did you write that? That was a blessing to me. I'm not talking about compliments. I think we can tell the difference, right? Flattery. And this flattery that we hear here doesn't seem to penetrate her heart. I'll show you what I mean. He was on to talk about her hair. You know, think about it, ladies. This guy is going on about how awesome you are. Your eyes are just, I can't even look at your eyes. They're so intriguing to me. Your hair is like a flock of goats that appears from Gilead. Wouldn't that stir your heart? Your teeth are like a flock of sheep. Huh? Brush. No. Anyway, your teeth are a flock of sheep, which go up from the washing. So nice and white is the idea. Everyone's got a partner right next to it. No barren twins. There's none barren among them. You know, all the spaces are filled is the idea. As a piece of pomegranate are your temples or cheeks within your locks. And then, would you hear this? There are 70 queens, 40 concubines, and virgins without number. That's kind of an odd thing to say right in the middle of all this compliment. Again, strong indication this is Solomon. You know, listen, you are the most beautiful. I know there's 60 queens and there's 80 concubines and there's virgins running around here. I'm telling you, you are an exception among them all. That, how does that do it for you, ladies? Does that make you, oh, really? Come here. Right? It doesn't exactly say to you, love, devotion, dedication. There's lots of polygamous language like that in the Song of Solomon. In the classic wedding chapter, a lot of polygamous description there about him having multiple wives and multiple virgins. I'm saying to you, I have a hard time believing that the love that she expresses for her beloved single fits in that context in any way, shape, or form. But he is trying to excuse all these other individuals, excuse them and say, my dove, verse 9, my undefiled is but one. You are special among them all. Save it, dude. She is the only one of her mother. She is the choice of her that bare her. The daughters saw her and blessed her. Yea, the queens and the concubines, they praised her. You, even they see it. Even they see that you're special among all of them. Who is she that looks forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and awesome or terrible as an army with banners? There is a very, powerful attempt to win this young lady's heart, and I would suggest personally to steer her heart towards himself. You can expect that. You can expect that in life. You can expect somebody, married couples in the room, to come along at some stage of your marriage and seek to steal your heart away. You can expect that. Are you prepared for that? What I really love in light of that is some advice that I learned personally from the book of Daniel. You know, in the book of Daniel, and my wife and I have talked a lot about this, in the book of Daniel, it gives us kind of a key to his success, and that is just this. It tells us that Daniel did what? He purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's delicacies. He made a plan in advance before the temptation ever arise. Isn't that cool? He had, like this, guys, think about it like this. If you can kind of put yourself in the hallways of your high school or your colleges, you know, because of building code and fire danger, especially in the world of regulations that we live in today, you probably never sat in a public classroom at all where you couldn't look to the right of the door and you see the little evacuation poster, right? You are here in the event of a fire. It has a very obvious predetermined path. It's usually red, and it tells you where the closest exit is. If there is danger in this room, this is you. This is how you get out of the danger ASAP. That is, you know, similar to the idea of having predetermined in my mind or purposing in my mind, if I'm ever confronted with this situation, here's my way of escape. And I think there's some wisdom to that. And can I suggest in the area in our marriages, as a country, as a state, as a church, where there's been horrible things that have taken place, I think I can rewind the tape and point to the fact there was no purpose in the heart. There was no predetermined plan. There was a real lack of wisdom, in some very practical things. And I'm just going to throw some convictions out there. I'm asking you to consider them. But as I was discipled and trained in ministry, something my pastor taught me, and I think there's wisdom to it personally, he had a rule, a policy in Calvary Chapel, Orienton, that a pastor could never counsel a female without somebody else present. Now, I realize that can very easily sound legalistic. Oh, I'm not even attracted. It's not about being attracted or not. It's about maintaining a standard where we are preventing a major problem from ever happening. Because as you do look at the world around us, there are so many pastors and professionals that fall prey to this counsel relationship issue, right? Or being a hero behind the scenes and having all the answers to all the problems. And even law enforcement often has the hero thing. They come in, they deal with the bad boyfriend, they're in uniform. There's so much that happens in our world. I believe just because there isn't enough accountability in the situation. Could it be that simple that in a counseling situation, I just bring my wife? If a female needs counsel, I'm a pastor. I believe I owe that to the church that I serve. I really can't. Okay? Plan B, Paul, what are you doing? I'll be right over, right? And me and the ugly Italian, right? We'll sit there and hey, my friend here, he's a good counselor. Sometimes it creates some awkwardness, but whatever the case may be, right? To bring a third person or at least keep the door open and somebody right there present in the room, you get the point, right? I just think there's some practical things we can do, church, that removes the flattery and the attention issues and the potential problems. You can call that legalistic. You can call it legalistic. Some do. But I'm going to go ahead and call it wise, especially in 2022, where there are so many good people, heroes that have fallen. And there has been leaders and has-been churches and has-been ministries. And I think you know what I'm talking about. People that we would promote. You got to read this guy's book. There's many people that I can no longer say, you got to read this guy's book, because unfortunately there wasn't a lifestyle to support the book. Do you know what I mean? And it's tragic. It breaks your heart. And I personally think avoidable in many cases. Avoidable in many cases. One more thing when it comes to accountability. We can chase each other around with flashlights and call it accountability. We could do that. That's so unnatural and worse than that, it's not very well received to chase each other around. What are you doing? Huh? Back there? Behind there? I personally believe in a concept. I actually learned this from one of my favorite musicians, Glenn Kaiser. It's called voluntary accountability. It is when I make myself accountable. It's when I take the flashlight and shine it for you. See that right there? I want you to see that. Here's my phone. Go through it. Check it out. It's something we willingly ask for and regularly willingly ask for. Huge difference, right? And it shows a heart, I think. Please, I want you to be able to trust me. I want to live above reproach as the scriptures teach. So ask yourself, wives in the room, when's the last time your husband said, look at it, look at my phone? And I'm not trying to cause problems, but do you have that relationship where there's a volunteer submission? Are you, my brother, so shallow and so junior high that when your wife asks for some kind of accountability, you're not my mother? That is unacceptable as far as I'm concerned. In a marriage relationship, she's worse than your mother. She's your wife, okay? And I think we absolutely should be. I think my wife has every right to know where I am in any moment, any moment. And does, actually, whether I like it or not, knows where I am at any moment. And there's an accountability there, and I personally like it. To this day, and it started because of addiction. It started early on in our marriage, where I would hand my paycheck to my wife because I was too much of a pansy to handle it. I still do that. I still receive an allowance from my wife. Here's your $20 bill, go to work, see you next week. And that's absolutely fine with me. I don't mind that. Is it humbling? Yeah, it's humbling. And I don't feel, by the way, like I'm a ticking time bomb anymore either. I feel like I've found victory, but it's just a habit at this point, and I like it. If there's a financial problem, I can blame her. It's genius. She's a spender, I got 20 bucks, so figure it out. All right, I had to do that, that was fun. I've actually had to learn how to, I've learned how to use Amazon, so I don't even need cash anyway. It's genius. A little further, church, a little further. She says this, the Shulamite woman says this in response to all that compliment. I went down into the garden. Remember last place she believed her beloved to be? Oh, that's where she's headed. I went down to the garden of nuts and to see the fruits of the valley and to see whether the vine flourished, the pomegranates budded, or ever I was aware my soul made me like the chariots of Abinadab. Poetic language, beautiful language, most scholars believe, and I wouldn't disagree. Something happened in this garden where she was swept away, taken away. The people that take the position that this is the shepherd hypothesis would make the case that she was taken back at this point. I have a couple of different thoughts, but I think that's a very plausible idea. Something in this garden swept her away like getting ripped off in a chariot. She didn't expect it, but from this point forward, you know, you certainly see some differences. She's gone from the scene for sure, and that's obvious by verse 13. Look what it says. Return, O Shulamite, return that we may look upon thee. That is that Jerusalem scene, whether it's Solomon and the ladies. Everybody in that Jerusalem scene is basically acknowledging, you're gone now. Come back. We want to look at you some more, acknowledging her beauty. But she's out of there. Fascinating. And then she says, what will you see in the Shulamite? As it were, the company of two armies. That's my old English Bible. Some of your newer translations say, you know what you'll see from this point forward when you look at me? Me dancing with another. Some of your translations suggest that, right? You see a twofold dance, right? In other words, a very poetic way of saying, I'm with him now, and we're dancing the night away. You won't see me anymore in your little charade there. Pretty cool, pretty interesting. All right? The Beloved, chapter 7, verse 1. How beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O prince's daughter. The joints of thy thighs are like jewels. This is a pretty intimate description, so hang with me, okay? Keep your eyes on the Bible. We won't look at each other for the next 30 seconds. We'll just read. It's safer that way. Anyway, yeah, the joints of your thighs are like jewels. Okay, there's that. The work of the hands of a cunning workman. Your navel is really round, like a round goblet. As opposed to what? I've always read that, like, as opposed to square? I don't know that there's many options, but I guess he's saying that she has an innie belly button. Thanks. Thanks. We've got confirmation, folks. Amen. which wants not liquor, okay? Yeah. Anyway. Thy belly is like a heap of wheat set about with lilies. Okay, so if you can picture a big sheath of wheat or a big bundle of wheat, and there's a cord around the middle of it, and they cinch up the wheat, so the waist kind of, you get the kind of an hourglass look going on. So your belly is like a sheath of wheat, which would be brought in a little tighter around the middle. Hope that's not weird. I'm just doing my best. This isn't my favorite book to teach publicly. Ready for this? Thy two breasts are like two young roes. That are twins. Huh? Thy neck is as a tower of ivory. So again, things that are always attractive and always have been attractive to men are being described here. You know, bellies and necks and eyes and all that. Your eyes like the fish pools of Heshbon by the gate of Beth Rabim. You know, two deep pools. That to me is cool. You know, when you fall in love with somebody and, you know, there's something about eye contact. You know, and specifically this is described as eyes that have depth to them, like staring into two pools. That to me is actually really meaningful. You know, out of all the descriptions and all the body parts that are described, that's personally my favorite one. Because when you fall in love with somebody, there's a history there, and there's a depth of person there.